This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Winds of War, written by Herman Woke, narrated by Kevin Pariseau.
Chapter 1. Commander Victor Henry rode a taxicab home from the Navy building on Constitution Avenue in a gusty, gray March rainstorm that matched his mood. In his war plans cubbyhole that afternoon, he had received an unexpected word from on high, which, to his seasoned appraisal, had probably blown a well-planned career to rags. Now he had to consult his wife about an urgent decision. Yet he did not altogether trust her opinions. At 45, Rhoda Henry remained a singularly attractive woman, but she was rather a crab. This colored her judgment, and it was a fault he found hard to forgive her. She had married him with her eyes open. During an incandescent courtship, they had talked frankly about the military life. Rhoda Grover had declared that all the drawbacks, the separations, the lack of a real place to live and of a normal family existence, the long, slow climb through a system, the need to be humbled to other men's wives when the men were a notch higher, that none of these things would trouble her because she loved him, and because the Navy was a career of honor. So she had said in 1915, when the World War was on and uniforms had a glow. This was 1939, and she had long since forgotten those words. He had warned her that the climb would be hard. Victor Henry was not of a Navy family. On every rung of the slippery career ladder, the sons and grandsons of admirals had been jostling him. Yet everyone in the Navy who knew Pug Henry called him a comer. Until now, his rise had been steady. The letter that first got him into the Naval Academy, written to his congressman while in high school, can be adduced here to characterize the man. He showed his form early. May 5th, 1910. Dear Sir, you have sent me three kind answers to three letters I have sent you, from my freshman year onward, reporting my progress in Sonoma County High School. So I hope that you will remember my name and my ambition to obtain appointment to the Naval Academy. Now I am about to complete my senior year. It may seem conceited to list my achievements, but I am sure you will understand why I do so. I am captain of the football team this year, playing fullback, and I am also on the boxing team. I have been elected to the Arista Society. In mathematics, history, and the sciences, I am a candidate for prizes. My English and foreign language, German marks, are not on that level. However, I am secretary of the small Russian-speaking club of our school. Its nine members come from local families whose ancestors were settled in Fort Ross long ago by the Tsar. My best chum was in the club, so I joined and learned some Russian. I mention this to show that my language ability is not deficient. My life aim is to serve as an officer in the United States Navy. I can't actually explain this, since my family has no seafaring background. My father is an engineer in the redwood lumbering business. I've never liked lumbering, but have always been interested in ships and big guns. I have gone to San Francisco and San Diego often, just to visit the naval ships there. Out of my savings, I have bought and studied about 24 books on marine engineering and sea warfare. I realize you have only one appointment to make, and there must be many applicants in our district. If one is found more deserving than I am, I will enlist in the Navy and work up from the ranks. However, I have seriously tried for your consideration and trust that I have earned it. Respectfully yours, Victor Henry. with much the same directness. Henry had won his wife 5 years later, though she was a couple of inches taller than he, and though her prosperous parents had looked for a better match than a squat Navy fullback from California, of no means or family. Courting Rhoda, he had come out of his single-minded shell of ambition to show much tenderness, humor, considerateness, and dash. After a month or two, Rhoda had lost any inclination to say no. Mundane details like height differences had faded from sight. Still, over the long pull, it may not be too good for a pretty woman to look down at her husband. Tall men tend to make plays for her, regarding the couple as slightly comic. Though a very proper woman, Rhoda had a weakness for this sort of thing, up to a point short of trouble, and even coyly provoked it. Henry's reputation as a bleak, hard-fibered individual discouraged the men from ever getting out of hand. He was very much Rhoda's master. Still, this physical detail was a continuing nag. The real shadow on this couple was that Commander Henry thought Rhoda had welched on their courtship understanding. She did what had to be done as a Navy wife, but she was free, loud, and frequent in her complaints. She could crab for months on end in a place she disliked, such as Manila. Wherever she was, she tended to fret about the heat, or the cold, or the rain, or the dry spell, or servants, or taxi drivers, or shop clerks, or seamstresses, or hairdressers. To hear Rhoda Henry's daily chatter, her life passed in combat with an incompetent world and a malignant climate. It was only female talk, and not in the least uncommon, but talk, not sex, constitutes most of the intercourse between a man and his wife. Henry detested idle whining. More and more, silence was the response he had come to use. It dampened the noise. On the other hand, Rhoda was two things he thought a wife should be, a seductive woman and an adroit homemaker. In all their married years, there had been few times when he had not desired her, and in all those years, for all their moving about, wherever they landed, Rhoda had provided a house or an apartment where the coffee was hot, the food appetizing, the rooms well furnished and always clean, the beds properly made, and fresh flowers in sight. She had fetching little ways, and when her spirits were good, she could be very sweet and agreeable. Most women, from the little Victor Henry knew of the sex, were vain, clacking slatterns, with less to redeem them than Rhoda had. His long-standing opinion was that, for all her drawbacks, he had a good wife, as wives went. That was a closed question. But heading home after a day's work, he never knew ahead of time whether he would encounter Rhoda the charmer or Rhoda the crab. At a crucial moment like this, it could make a great difference. In her down moods, her judgments were snappish and often silly. Coming into the house, he heard her singing in the glassed-in heated porch off the living room, where they usually had drinks before dinner. He found her arranging tall stalks of orange gladiolus in an oxblood vase from Manila. She was wearing a beige, silky dress cinched in by a black patent leather belt with a large silver buckle. Her dark hair fell in waves behind her ears. This was a fashion in 1939, even for mature women. Her welcoming glance was affectionate and gay. Just to see her so made him feel better, and this had been going on all his life.
"Oh, hi there! Why on earth didn't you warn me Kip Tolliver was coming? He sent these, and luckily he called, too. I was slopping around this house like a scrubwoman."
Rhoda, in casual talk, used the swooping high notes of smart Washington women. She had a dulcet, rather husky voice, and these zoomed words of hers gave what she said enormous emphasis and some illusion of sparkle.
He said he might be slightly late. Let's have a short one, Pug, okay? The fixings are all there. I'm parched.
Henry walked to the wheeled bar and began to mix martinis. I asked Kip to stop by so I could talk to him. It's not a social visit.
Oh, am I supposed to make myself scarce?
She gave him a sweet smile.
No, no. Good. I like Kip. Why, I was flabbergasted to hear his voice. I thought he was still stuck in Berlin.
He's been detached.
So he told me. Who relieved him, do you know?
Nobody has. The assistant attaché for air took over temporarily. Victor Henry handed her a cocktail. He sank in a brown wicker armchair, put his feet up on the ottoman, and drank, gloom enveloping him again. Rhoda was used to her husband's silences. She had taken in his bad humor at a glance. Victor Henry held himself very straight, except in moments of trial and tension. Then he tended to fall into a crouch, as though he were still playing football. He had entered the room hunched, and even in the armchair, with his feet up, his shoulders were bent. Dark, straight hair hung down his forehead. At 49, he had almost no gray hairs, and his charcoal slacks, brown sports jacket, and red bow tie were clothes for a younger man. It was his small vanity, when not in uniform, to dress youthfully. An athletic body helped him carry it off. Rhoda saw in the lines around his greenish-brown eyes that he was tired and deeply worried. Possibly from long years of peering out to sea, Henry's eyes were permanently marked with what looked like laugh lines. Strangers mistook him for a genial man.
"Got a dividend there?" he said at last.
She poured the watery drink for him.
"Thanks. Say, incidentally, you know that memorandum on the battleships that I wrote?"
"Oh, yes. Was there a backlash? You were concerned, I know."
"I got called down to the CNO's office."
"My God, to see Preble?"
"Preble himself. I hadn't seen him since the old days on the California. He's gotten fat."
Henry told her about his talk with the chief of naval operations. Rhoda's face took on a hard, sullen, puzzled look.
"Oh, I see. That's why you asked Kip over."
"Exactly. What do you think about my taking this attaché job?"
"Since when do you have any choice?"
"He gave me the impression that I did, that if I didn't want it, I'd go to a battle wagon next, as an exec."
"Good Lord, Pug, that's more like it."
"You'd prefer that I go back to sea?"
"I'd prefer. What difference has that ever made?"
"All the same, I'd like to hear what you'd prefer."
Rhoda hesitated, sizing him up with a slanted glance.
"Well, naturally, I'd adore going to Germany. It would be much more fun for me than sitting here alone while you steam around Hawaii in the New Mexico or whatever. It's the loveliest country in Europe. The people are so friendly. German was my major, you know, eons ago."
"I know," Victor Henry said, smiling, if faintly and wryly, for the first time since arriving home. "You were very good at German."
Some of the early hot moments of their honeymoon had occurred while they stumbled through Heine's love poetry aloud together. Rhoda returned an arch glance, redolent of married sex.
"Well, all right, you. All I mean is, if you must leave Washington, I suppose the Nazis are kind of ugly and ridiculous, but Madge Knudsen went there for the Olympics. She keeps saying it's still wonderful, and so cheap, with those tourist marks they give you."
"Yes, no doubt we'd have a gay whirl. The question is, Rhoda, whether this isn't a total disaster. Two shore assignments in a row, you understand. At this stage—"
"Oh, Pug, you'll get your four stripes. I know you will. And you'll get your battleship command, too, in due course. My God, with your gunnery pennants, your letter of commendation—" "Pug, Suppose CNO's right. Maybe a war is about to pop over there. Then it would be an important job, wouldn't it?
That's just sales talk.
Pug got up and helped himself to cheese.
He says the president wants top men in Berlin now as military attachés. Well, okay, I'll believe that. He also says it won't hurt my career. That's what I can't believe.
First thing any selection board looks for, or will ever look for, in a man's record, is blue water, and lots of it.
Pug, are you sure Kip won't stay to dinner? There's plenty of food. Warren's going to New York.
No, Kip's on his way to a party at the German embassy. And why the hell is Warren going to New York? He's been home all of 3 days.
Ask him, Rhoda said.
The slam of the front door and the quick, firm steps were unmistakable Warren sounds. He entered the porch, greeting them with a wave of 2 squash rackets in a fist.
Hi.
In an old gray sweater and slacks, his tanned, lean face glowing from the exercise, his hair tousled, a cigarette slanting from his thin mouth, he looked much like the lad who, on graduating from the academy, had vanished from their lives. Pug was still not used to the way Warren had filled out on shipboard food. The boyish weediness was changing into a tall, solid look. A sprinkle of premature gray in his dark hair had startled his parents on his return. Victor Henry envied Warren the deep sunburn which bespoke a destroyer bridge, tennis, green Oahu hills, and, above all, duty at sea, thousands of miles from Constitution Avenue. He said,
"You're off to New York, I hear."
"Yes, Dad. Is that okay? My exec just blew into town. We're going up there to see some shows. He's a real Idaho farmer. Never been to New York."
Commander Henry made a grouchy sound. It was no bad thing for Warren to be friendly with his executive officer. What bothered the father was thoughts of a woman who might be waiting in New York. A top student at the academy, Warren had almost ruined his record with excessive Frenching out. He had ended with a bad back, attributed by himself to a wrestling injury, by other reports, to an escapade involving an older woman and a midnight car crash. The parents had never raised the topic of the woman, partly from bashfulness — they were both prudish churchgoers, ill at ease with such a topic — and partly from a strong sense that they would get nowhere with Warren. The door chimes rang. A gray-headed houseman in a white coat passed through the living room. Rhoda stood up, touching her hair and sliding slim hands over her silk-clad hips.
"Remember Kip Tolliver, Warren? That's probably Kip."
"Why, sure, that tall lieutenant commander who lived next door in Manila. Where's he stationed now?"
"He's just finished a tour as naval attaché in Berlin," Victor Henry said.
Warren made a comic grimace and dropped his voice.
"Jehoshaphat, Dad, how did he ever get stuck with that? Cookie pusher in an embassy."
Rhoda looked at her husband, whose face remained impassive.
"Commander Tolliver, ma'am," said the houseman at the doorway.
"Hello, Rhoda."
Tolliver marched in with long arms outstretched, in a flawlessly cut evening uniform. Blue mess jacket with medals and gold buttons, a black tie, a stiff, snowy shirt.
"My lord, woman, you look 10 years younger than you did in the Philippines."
"Oh, you," she said, eyes gleaming, as he lightly kissed her cheek.
"Hi, Pug."
Smoothing one manicured hand over heavy, wavy hair just turning gray, Tolliver stared at the sun.
"Now, for crying out loud, which boy is this?"
Warren held out his hand.
"Hello, sir. Guess."
"Aha, it's Warren." Byron had a different grin.
"And red hair, come to think of it."
"Right you are, sir."
Rusty Trainer told me you're serving in the Monaghan. What's Byron doing?
Rhoda chirruped after a slight silence.
Oh, Byron's our romantic dreamer, Kip. He's studying fine arts in Italy.
And you should see Madeline, all grown up.
Warren said, Excuse me, sir, and went out.
Fine arts, Italy.
One heavy eyebrow went up in Tolliver's gaunt, handsome face, and his cobalt blue eyes widened.
Well, that is romantic. Say, Pug, since when do you indulge?
Tolliver inquired, accepting a martini and seeing Henry refill his own glass.
Why, hell, Kip, I was drinking in Manila, plenty.
Were you? I forget. I just remember what a roaring teetotaler you were in the academy. No tobacco, either.
Well, I fell from grace long ago.
Victor Henry had started to drink and smoke on the death of an infant girl, and had not returned to the abstinences his strict Methodist father had taught him. It was a topic he did not enjoy exploring. With a slight smile, Tolliver said,
Do you play cards on Sunday now, too?
No, I still hold to that bit of foolishness.
Don't call it foolishness, Pug.
Commander Tolliver began to talk about the post of naval attaché in Berlin.
You'll love Germany, were his first words on the topic. And so will Rhoda. You'd be crazy not to grab the chance.
Resting his elbows on the arms of his chair, legs neatly crossed, he clipped out his words with all the old, articulate crispness. Still one of the handsomest men in Pug's class, and one of the unluckiest. 2 years out of the academy, while officer of the deck of a destroyer, Tolliver had rammed a submarine at night in a rain squall, during a fleet exercise. The submarine had surfaced without warning 100 yards in front of him. It had scarcely been his fault. Nobody had been hurt, and the general court-martial had merely given him a letter of reprimand. But that letter had festered in his promotion jacket, sapping his career. He drank 2 martinis in about 15 minutes as he talked. When Victor Henry probed a bit about the Nazis and how to deal with them, Kip Tolliver sat up very erect. His curled fingers stiffened as he gestured, and his tone grew firm. The National Socialists were in, he said, and the other German parties were out, just as in the United States, the Democrats were in and the Republicans out. That was the one way to look at it. The Germans admired the United States and desperately wanted our friendship. Pug would find the latch off and the channels of information open if he simply treated these people as human beings. The press coverage of the new Germany was distorted. When Pug got to know the newspapermen, he would understand why. Disgruntled pinkos and drunks, most of them.
Hitler's a damned remarkable man, said Tolliver, poised on his elbows, one scrubbed hand to his chin, one negligently dangling, his face flushed bright pink.
I'm not saying that he or Goering or any of that bunch wouldn't murder their own grandmothers to increase their power or to advance the interests of Germany, but that's politics in Europe nowadays. We Americans are far too naive.
The Soviet Union is the one big reality Europe lives with, Pug. That Slav horde seething in the East. We can hardly picture that feeling, but for them it's political bedrock. The Communist International is not playing Mahjong, you know. Those bolos are out to rule Europe by fraud or force or both. Hitler isn't about to let them. That's the root of the matter. The Germans do things in politics that we wouldn't, like this stuff with the Jews, but that's just a passing phase. And anyway, it's not your business. Remember that. Your job is military information. You can get a hell of a lot of that from these people. They're proud of what they're accomplishing, and not at all bashful about showing off. And I mean, they'll give you the real dope.
Rhoda asked questions about the Jews, as Pug Henry mixed more martinis. Tolliver assured her that the newspaper stories were exaggerated. The worst thing had been the so-called Crystal Night, when Nazi toughs had smashed department store windows and set fire to some synagogues. Even that the Jews had brought on themselves by murdering a German embassy official in Paris. As an embassy official himself, Tolliver said, he took rather a dim view of that. He and his wife had gone to the theater that very night, and on the way home he had seen a lot of broken glass along the Kurfürstendamm and the glow of a couple of distant fires. The account, in time, had made it seem that Germany was ablaze from end to end, and that the Jews were being slaughtered en masse. There had been conflicting reports, but, so far as he knew, not one of them had really been physically harmed. A big fine had been put on them for the death of the official, a billion marks or something. Hitler did believe in strong medicine. Now, as to the president's recalling our ambassador, that was a superfluous gesture, utterly superfluous, Tolliver said. It only made things worse for the Jews, and it completely fouled up our embassy's workings. There's just no common sense here in Washington about Germany. Drinking two more martinis, the erect warrior began dissolving into a gossipy, slouched Navy insider, reminiscing about parties, weekends, hunting trips, and the like. About the potato soup he had drunk with Luftwaffe officers in the dawn, while recovering from a drinking bout after a party rally. About the famous actors and politicians who had befriended him. Great fun and high living went with the attaché's job, he chuckled, if one played one's cards right. Moreover, you were supposed to do those things, so as to dig up information. It was dream duty. A man was entitled to get whatever he could out of the Navy. He had sat in a front seat, watching history unfold, and he had had a glorious time besides. I tell you, you'll love it, Pug. It's the most interesting post in Europe nowadays. The Nazis are a mixed crowd, actually. Some are brilliant, but between you and me, some are pretty crude and vulgar. The professional military crowd sort of looks down on them. But hell, how do we feel about our own politicians? Hitler's in the saddle, and nobody's arguing about that. He is boss man, and I kid you not. So lay off that topic and you'll do fine, because really, you can't beat these people for hospitality. In a way, they're a lot like us, you know. More so than the French, or even the Limeys. They'll turn themselves inside out for an American naval officer. A strange smile, rueful and somewhat beaten, appeared on his face as he glanced from Rhoda to Pug. Especially a man like you. They'll know all about you long before you get there. Now, if this is off the reservation, say so, but how on earth did a gunnery red-hot like you come up for this job?
Stuck my neck out, Pug growled.
You know the work I did on the magnetic torpedo exploder when I was at Buord?
Hell yes, and the letter of commendation you got, I sure do.
Well, I've watched torpedo developments since. Part of my job in war plans is monitoring the latest intelligence on armor and armaments. The Japs are making some mighty healthy torpedoes, Kip. I got out the old slide rule one night and ran the figures. And the way I read them, our battle wagons are falling below the safety margin. I wrote a report recommending that the blisters be thickened and raised on the Maryland and New Mexico classes. Today, CNO called me down to his office. My reports turned into a hot potato. Bew ships and Buord are blaming each other. Memos are flying like fur. The blisters are going to be thickened and raised, and by God, Pug, you've got yourself another letter of commendation. Well done! Tolliver's brilliant blue eyes glistened, and he wet his lips. I've got myself orders to Berlin, Victor Henry said, unless I can talk my way out of it. CNO says the White House has decided it's a crucial post now. It is, Pug, it is.
Well, maybe so, but hell's bells, Kip. You're wonderful at that sort of thing. I'm not. I'm a grease monkey. I don't belong there. I had the misfortune to call attention to myself, that's all, when the boss man was looking for someone. And I happen to know some German. Now I'm in a crack. Tolliver glanced at his watch.
Well, don't pass this up. That's my advice to you as an old friend. Hitler is very, very important, and something's going to blow in Europe. I'm overdue at the embassy.
Victor Henry walked him outside to his shiny gray Mercedes. Tolliver's gait was shaky, but he spoke with calm clarity.
Pug, if you do go, call me. I'll give you a book full of phone numbers of the right men to talk to. In fact,
a twisted grin came and went on his face.
No, the numbers of the little Fräuleins would be wasted on you, wouldn't they? Well, I've always admired the hell out of you.
He clapped Henry's shoulder.
God, I'm looking forward to this party. I haven't drunk a decent glass of Moselle since I left Berlin.
Re-entering the house, Victor Henry almost stumbled over a suitcase and a hatbox. His daughter stood at the foyer mirror in a green wool suit, putting on a close-fitting hat. Rhoda was watching her, and Warren waited, trench coat slung on his shoulder, holding his old pigskin valise.
"What's this, Madeline? Where are you going?"
She smiled at him, opening wide, dark eyes.
"Oh, didn't Mom tell you? Warren's taking me to New York."
Pug looked dourly at Rhoda, who said,
"Anything wrong with that, dear? Warren's lined up extra tickets for the shows. She loves the theater, and there's precious little in Washington."
"But has college closed down? Is this the Easter vacation?"
The daughter said,
"I'm caught up in my work. It's only for 2 days, and I don't have any tests."
"And where would you stay?"
Warren put in, "There's this Hotel Barbizon for women."
"I don't like this," Victor Henry said.
Madeline glanced at him with melting appeal. 19 and slight, with Rhoda's skin and a pert figure, she oddly resembled her father in the deep-set brown eyes and the determined air. She tried wrinkling her small nose at him. Often that made him laugh and won her point. This time his face did not change. Madeline glanced at her mother and then at Warren for support, but it was not forthcoming. A little smile curved Madeline's mouth, more ominous, perhaps, than a rebellious tantrum. A smile of indulgence. She took off her hat.
"Well, okay, that's that. Warren, I hope you can get rid of those extra tickets. When's dinner?"
"Any time," Rhoda said. Warren donned his trench coat and picked up the suitcase.
"Say, incidentally, Dad, did I mention that a couple of months ago my exec put in for flight training? I sent in one of the forms, too, just for the hell of it. Well, Chet was snooping around Bunave today. It seems we both have a chance."
"Flight training?" Rhoda looked unhappy. "You mean you're becoming a carrier pilot just like that? Without consulting your father?"
"Why, Mom, it's just something else to qualify in. I think it makes sense. Doesn't it, sir?"
Commander Henry said,
"Yes, indeed. The future of this here Navy might just belong to the brown shoes."
"I don't know about that, but Pensacola ought to be interesting, if I don't bilge out the first week. Back Friday. Sorry, Madeline."
She said, "Nice try. Have fun." He kissed his mother and left. Pug Henry consumed vichyssoise, London broil, and strawberry tart in grim, abstracted silence. Kip Tolliver's enthusiasm for the mediocre spying job had only deepened Henry's distaste. Madeline's itch to avoid schoolwork was a steady annoyance, but topping all was Warren's casually dropped news. Pug was both proud and alarmed.
carrier aviation was the riskiest duty in the Navy, though officers even his own age were now applying for Pensacola, so as to get into the flat tops. A devoted battleship man, Henry wondered all through the meal whether Warren hadn't hit on something, whether a request for flight training might not be a respectable, if desperate, way to dodge Berlin. Madeline kept a cheerful face, making talk with her mother about the student radio station at George Washington University, her main interest there. The houseman, an old Irishman who also did the gardening in warm weather, walked softly in the candlelit dining room, furnished with Rhoda's family antiques. Rhoda contributed money to the household costs so that they could live in this style in Washington, among her old friends. While Victor Henry did not like it, he had not argued. A commander's salary was modest, and Rhoda was used to this better life. Madeline excused herself early, kissing her father on the forehead. The somber quiet during dessert was unbroken except by the hushed footfalls of the manservant. Rhoda said nothing, waiting out her husband's mood. When he cleared his throat and said it might be nice to have brandy and coffee on the porch, she smiled pleasantly.
"Yes, let's, Pug."
The houseman set the silver tray there, turning up the red flickering light in the artificial fireplace. She waited until her husband was settled in his favorite chair, drinking coffee and sipping brandy. Then she said,
"By the by, there's a letter from Byron."
"What? He actually remembered we're alive? Is he all right?" They had not heard from him in months. Henry had had many a nightmare of his son dead in an Italian ditch in a smoking automobile, or otherwise killed or injured, but since the last letter he had not mentioned Byron.
"He's all right. He's in Siena. He's given up his studies in Florence. Says he got bored with fine arts."
I couldn't be less surprised. Siena, that's still Italy, isn't it?
"Yes, near Florence, in the Tuscan hills." He goes on and on about the Tuscan hills. "He seems to be interested in a girl."
"A girl, huh? What kind of girl? Italian?"
"No, no, a New York girl. Natalie Jastrow. He says she has a famous uncle."
"I see. And who's her uncle?"
"He's an author. He lives in Siena. Dr. Aaron Jastrow. He once taught history at Yale, Briney says."
"Where's the letter?"
"On the telephone table."
He returned in a few minutes with the letter, and with a thick book in a black dust jacket, marked with a white crucifix and a blue Star of David. "That's who the uncle is."
"Oh, yes, a Jew's Jesus, that thing. Some club sent it. Did you ever read it?"
"I read it twice. It's excellent." Henry scanned his son's letter in yellow lamplight. "Well, this business is kind of far along."
"She does sound attractive," Rhoda said, "but he's had other nine-day wonders."
Commander Henry tossed the letter on the coffee table and poured more brandy for himself. "I'll read it through later. Longest letter he's ever written. Is there anything important in it?"
"He wants to stay on in Italy."
"Indeed. How does he propose to live?"
"He has some kind of research job with Dr. Jastrow. The girl works there, too. He thinks he can get by on what he earns, plus the few dollars from my mother's trust."
"Really?"
Henry peered at her.
"If Byron Henry is talking about supporting himself, that's the biggest news about him since you had him." He drank his coffee and brandy and stood up, retrieving the letter with a swipe of his hand.
"Now, don't take on, Pug. Byron's a strange fish, but there's a lot of brains underneath."
"I have some work to do." Henry went to his den and smoked a cigar, reading Byron's letter twice through with care. The den was a converted maid's room.
On the ground floor, a large, handsome study looked out on the garden through French windows. That room, in theory, was his. It was so attractive that Rhoda sometimes liked to receive visitors there, and was given to nagging at her husband when he left papers and books around. After a few months of this, Henry had put bookshelves, a cot, and a tiny second-hand desk in the narrow maid's room, had moved into it, and was content enough with this small space. He had done with less in a destroyer cabin. When the cigar was burned out, Henry went to his old portable typewriter. With his hands on the keys, he paused, contemplating three pictures in a leather frame on the desk. Warren, in uniform and bristle-headed, a stern boyish candidate for flag rank. Madeline, at 17, much, much younger than she seemed now. Byron, in the center, with the defiant, large mouth, the half-closed analytic eyes, the thick, full hair, the somewhat sloping face, peculiarly mingling softness and obstinate will. Byron owed his looks to neither parent. He was his strange self. Dear Briny, your mother and I have your long letter. I intend to take it seriously. Your mother prefers to poo-poo it, but I don't think you've written such a letter before, or described a girl in quite such terms. I'm glad you're well, and gainfully employed. That's good news. I never could take that fine arts business seriously. Now, about Natalie Jastrow. In this miserable day and age, especially with what is going on in Germany, I have to start by protesting that I have nothing against Jewish people. I have encountered them very little, since few of them enter the Navy. In my academy class, there were four, which was very unusual back in 1911. One of them has stayed the course, Hank Goldfarb, and he is a damned good officer. Here in Washington, there is quite a bit of prejudice against Jews. They've made themselves felt in business lately, doing somewhat too well. The other day, one of your mother's friends told me a joke. I wasn't amused, possibly because of my own Glasgow great-grandfather. The three shortest books in the Library of Congress are A History of Scotch Charities, Virginity in France, and A Study of Jewish Business Ethics. Ha, ha, ha. This may be a far cry from Hitler's propaganda, but the person who told me this joke is a fine lawyer and a good Christian. You'd better give some hard thought to the long pull that a marriage is. I know I'm jumping the gun, but now is the time to reflect before you're too involved. Never, never forget one thing. The girl you marry and the woman you must make a life with are two different people. Women have a way of living in the present. Before marriage, she's out to win you. Afterward, you're just one of the many factors in her life. In a way, you're secondary, because she has you, whereas everything else is in flux. Children, household, new clothes, social ties. If these other factors are disagreeable to her, she will make you unhappy. In a marriage with a girl like Natalie Jastrow, the other factors would all tend to bother her perpetually, from the mixed-breed children to the tiny social slights. These might get to be like the Chinese water drop torture. If so, you'd both gradually grow bitter and miserable, and by then you'd be tied together by children. This could end up as hell on earth. Now, I'm just telling you what I think. Maybe I'm old-fashioned or stupid and out of touch. It doesn't matter to me that this girl is Jewish, though there would be grave questions about the children's faith, since I feel you're a pretty good Christian, somewhat more so than Warren at the moment. I'm impressed by what you say about her brains, which her being the niece of Aaron Jastrow sure bears out. A Jew's Jesus is a remarkable work.
If I thought she could make you happy and give you some direction in life, I'd welcome her, and take pleasure in personally punching in the nose anybody who upset her. But I think this might become a second career for me. Now, I'm reconciled to letting you go your own way. You know that. It's hard for me to write a letter like this. I feel like a fool, elaborating the obvious, expressing truths that I find distasteful, and above all, intruding on your personal feelings. But that's okay. You sent us your letter. I take it to mean that you wanted an answer. This is the best I can do. If you want to write me off as a bigot, that's all right with me. I'll show this letter to your mother, who will, no doubt, disapprove of it, so I'll be forwarding it without her endorsement. Maybe she'll add something of her own. Warren is home. He is put in for flight training, and may get it. Love, Dad. Rhoda liked to sleep late, but her husband woke her the following morning at 8 o'clock, handing her his letter to Byron and a cup of hot coffee. She sat up with grouchy, abrupt gestures, read the letter through as she sipped, and passed it back to him without a word.
"Do you want to add anything?"
"No." Her face was set. She had worked her eyebrows a bit over Pug's passage on women and marriage.
"Don't you approve of it?"
"Letters like that don't change things," Rhoda said with deep, sure female contempt.
"Shouldn't I send it?"
"I don't care." He put the envelope in his breast pocket.
"I see Admiral Preble at 10 o'clock this morning. Have you had any second thoughts?"
"Pug, will you please do exactly as you choose?" Rhoda said, in a pained, bored tone. She sank down into the bedclothes as he left.
The chief of naval operations did not appear surprised when Pug said he would take the post. At dawn, Henry had awakened with an overmastering sense that he could not duck the assignment, and with this he had stopped thinking about it. Preble told him to get ready in a hurry. His orders to Berlin were already cut.
Chapter 2
Byron Henry's encounter with Natalie Jastrow 2 months earlier had been much in character. He had drifted into it. Unlike his father, Byron had always been directionless. Growing up, he had dodged the Sea Scouts, Severn Academy, and anything else pointing to a naval career. Yet he had no ideas for any other career. His marks were usually poor, and he developed early a remarkable capacity for doing absolutely nothing. In fits of resolve, he had shown himself able to win a few A's, or put together a radio set that worked, or rescue an old car from a junkyard and make it run, or repair a collapsed oil heater. In this knack for machinery, he took after his father and grandfather, but he became bored with such tinkering. He did too poorly in mathematics to think of engineering. He might have been an athlete. He was agile and sturdier than he looked, but he disliked the regimens and teamwork of school athletics, and he loved cigarettes and beer, though the gallons of beer he drank did not add a millimeter to his waistline. At Columbia College, where he was admitted because he charmed an interviewer, scored well on the intelligence test, and wasn't a New Yorker, he barely avoided expulsion for bad grades. What he enjoyed was taking his ease at his fraternity house, or playing cards and pool, or reading old novels over and over, or talking about girls and fooling with them. He did find in fencing a sport suited to his independent temper and his wiry body. Had he trained more, he might have been an intercollegiate finalist at the Epee. But it was a bore to train, and it interfered with his idleness. In his junior year, he elected a course in fine arts,
which athletes took because, so the report ran, nobody ever failed it. However, at mid-semester, Byron Henry managed to fail. He had done no work and cut half the classes. Still, the F startled him. He went to see the professor and told him so. The professor, a mild, bald little lover of the Italian Renaissance, with green spectacles and hairy ears, took a liking to him. A couple of remarks Byron made on Leonardo and Botticelli showed that in the few sessions he had attended, he had learned something, unlike the rest of the hulking, somnolent class. They became friends. It was the first intellectual friendship in Byron Henry's life. He became an enthusiast for the Renaissance, slavishly echoing the professor's ideas, and he finished college in a blaze of B pluses, cured of beer guzzling and a fire to teach fine arts. 1 year of graduate work at the University of Florence for a Master of Arts degree. That had been the plan. But a few months in Florence cooled Byron. One rainy November night, in his squalid rented room overlooking the muddy Arno, sick of the smells of garlic and bad plumbing, and of living alone among foreigners, he wrote his friend that Italian painting was garish, saccharine, and boring with its everlasting Madonnas, babes, saints, halos, crucifixions, resurrections, green dead saviors, flying bearded Jehovahs, and the rest. That he much preferred moderns, like Miro and Clay. And that, anyway, painting was just interior decoration, which didn't really interest him. He scrawled several pages in this cornered rat vein, mailed them off, and then went vagabonding around Europe, forsaking his classes and his hope of a graduate degree. When he got back to Florence, he found a cheering letter from the professor. "I don't know what will become of you. Obviously, art was a false lead. I think it did you good to get hot on some subject. If you can only shake off your lethargy and find something that truly engages you, you may yet go far. I am an old traffic cop, and standing here on my corner, I have seen many Chevrolets and Fords go by. It's not hard for me to recognize the occasional Cadillac. Only this one seems badly stalled. I've written about you to Dr. Aaron Jastro, who lives outside Siena. You know of him. He wrote A Jew's Jesus, made a pot of money, and got off the miserable academic treadmill. We used to be friends at Yale, and he was very good indeed at bringing out the best in young men. Go and talk to him, and give him my regards." That was how Byron happened to call on Dr. Jastro. He took a bus to Siena, a 3-hour run up a rutted, scary mountain road. Twice before, he had visited the bizarre little town, all red towers and battlements and narrow, crooked streets, set around a gaudy, zebra-striped cathedral on a hilltop amid rolling green and brown Tuscan vineyards. Its main claim to fame, aside from the quasi-Byzantine church art he had studied there, was a peculiar annual horse race called the Palio, which he had heard about but never seen. At first glance, the girl at the wheel of the old blue convertible made no strong impression on him. An oval face, dark enough so that he first took her for an Italian, dark hair, enormous sunglasses, a pink sweater over an open white shirt. Beside her sat a blonde man covering a yawn with a long white hand. "Hi, Byron Henry?" "Yes. Hop in the back. I'm Natalie Jastro. This is Leslie Sloat. He works in our embassy in Paris, and he's visiting my uncle." Byron did not much impress the girl either. What Natalie Jastro saw through the dark glasses was a slender lounger, obviously American, with red glints in his heavy brown hair. He was propped against the wall of the Hotel Continental in the sun, smoking a cigarette, his legs loosely crossed.
The light gray jacket, dark slacks, and maroon tie were faintly dandyish. The forehead under the hair was wide, the long slanting jaws narrow, the face pallid. He looked like what he was, a collegiate drone, a rather handsome one. Natalie had brushed these off by the dozen in earlier years. As they wound through narrow canyons of crooked ancient red-brown houses and drove out into the countryside, Byron idly asked Sloat about his embassy work. The Foreign Service man told him he was posted in the political section and was studying Russian and Polish, hoping for an assignment to Moscow or Warsaw. Sitting in the car, Sloat appeared very tall. Later, Byron saw that he himself was taller than Sloat. The Foreign Service officer had a long trunk but medium-sized legs. Sloat's thick blonde hair grew to a peak over a high forehead and narrow pinkish face. The light blue eyes behind rimless glasses were alert and penetrating, and his thin lips were compressed as though with habitual resolve. All the time they drove, he held a large black pipe in his hand or in his mouth, not smoking it. It occurred to Byron that the Foreign Service might be a pleasant career, offering travel, adventure, and encounters with important people. But when Sloat mentioned that he was a Rhodes Scholar, Byron decided not to pursue the topic. Jastrow lived in a yellow stucco villa on a steep hillside, with a fine view of the cathedral and Siena's red towers and tile roofs. It was a drive of about 20 minutes from town. Byron hurried after the girl and Sloat through a terraced flowering garden full of black-stained plaster statues.
"Well, there you are!"
The voice was high, authoritative, and impatient, with a faint foreign note in the pronouncing of the R's. Two sights struck Byron as they entered a long-beamed living room, a painting of a red-robed St. Francis with arms outstretched on a background of gold, taking up a good part of one wall, and far down the long sitting room on a red silk couch, a bearded little man in a light gray suit who looked at his watch, stood, and came toward them coughing. "This is Byron Henry, Aaron," the girl said. Jastrow took Byron's hand in two dry little paws and peered up at him with prominent, wavering eyes. Jastrow's head was large, his shoulders slight. He had aging, freckled skin, light, straight hair, and a heavy nose reddened by a cold. The neatly trimmed beard was all gray.
"Columbia 38, is it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, well, come along."
He went off down the room, buttoning the flapping folds of his double-breasted suit.
"Come here, Byron."
Plucking the stopper out of a heavy crystal decanter, he carefully poured amber wine into four glasses.
"Come, Leslie, Natalie. We don't take wine during the day, Byron, but this is an occasion."
He held up his glass.
"To Mr. Byron Henry, eminent hater of the Italian Renaissance."
Byron laughed. "Is that what Dr. Milano wrote? I'll drink to that." Jastrow took one sip, put down his glass, and looked at his watch. Seeing the professor wanted to get at his lunch, Byron tossed off the sherry like a shot of rye. Jastrow exclaimed with a delighted smile,
"Ah, 1, 2, 3. Good lad. Come along, Natalie, Leslie. Take your glass to the table."
It was a spare lunch, nothing but vegetables with white rice, then cheese and fruit. The service was on fine old china, maroon and gold. A small, gray-headed Italian woman passed the food. The tall dining room windows stood open to the garden, the view of Siena, and a flood of pale sunshine. Gusts of cool air came in as they ate.
When they first sat, the girl said, "What have you got against the Italian Renaissance, Byron?" "That's a long story."
"Tell us," said Jastrow in a classroom voice, laying a thumb across his smiling mouth.
Byron hesitated. Jastrow and the Rhodes Scholar made him uneasy. The girl disconcerted him more. Removing her sunglasses, she had disclosed big, slanted, dark eyes, gleaming with bold intelligence. She had a soft, large mouth, painted a bit too orange in a bony face. Natalie was regarding him with a satiric look, as though she had already concluded that he was a fool. And Byron was not fool enough to miss that.
"Maybe I've had too much of it," he said. "I started out fascinated. I'm ending up snowed under and bored. I realize much of art is brilliant, but there's a lot of overrated garbage amid the works of genius. My main objection is that I can't take the mixture of paganism and Christianity. I don't believe David looked like Apollo, or Moses like Jupiter, or Mary like every Renaissance artist's mistress with a borrowed baby on her lap. Maybe they couldn't help showing Bible Jews as local Italians or pseudo-Greeks, but—"
Byron dried up for a moment, seeing his listeners' amused looks.
"Look, I'm not saying any of this is important criticism. I guess it just shows I got into the wrong field. But what has any of it to do with Christianity? That's what sticks in my craw. Supposing Christ came back to Earth and visited the Uffizi, or St. Peter's. The Christ of your book, Dr. Jastrow, the poor, idealistic Jewish preacher from the back hills. That's the Lord I grew up with. My father's a religious man. We had to read a chapter of the Bible every morning at home. Why, Christ wouldn't even suspect the stuff related to himself and his teachings."
Natalie Jastrow was regarding him with an almost motherly smile. He said brusquely to her, "Okay, you asked me what I had against the Italian Renaissance. I've told you."
"Well, it's a point of view," she said.
Eyes twinkling behind his glasses, Sloat lit his pipe and said between puffs,
"Don't fold up, Byron. There are others who have taken your position. A good name for it is Protestantism."
"Byron's main point is accurate," Dr. Jastrow sounded kindly, dancing his little fingers together. "The Italian Renaissance was a great blossoming of art and ideas, Byron, that occurred when paganism and the Hebrew spirit, in its Christian expression, briefly fertilized instead of fighting each other. It was a hybrid growth, true, but some hybrids are stronger than either parent, you know. Witness the mule."
"Yes, sir," said Byron, "and mules are sterile." Amused surprise flashed on Natalie Jastrow's face, and her enormous dark eyes flickered to Leslie Sloat, and back to Byron.
"Well said, just so."
Jastrow nodded in a pleased way.
"The Renaissance indeed couldn't reproduce itself, and it died off, while the pagan and Hebrew spirits went their separate immortal ways. But that mule's bones are now one of mankind's richest deposits of cultural achievement, Byron, whatever your momentary disgust from overexposure."
Byron shrugged. Leslie Sloat said, "Is your father a clergyman?"
"His father's a naval officer," said Jastrow.
"Really? What branch?" Byron said, "Well, right now he's in war plans."
"My goodness, war plans?"
Dr. Jastrow pretended a comic flutter.
"I didn't know that. Is it as ominous as it sounds?"
"Sir, every country draws up theoretical war plans in peacetime."
"Does your father think a war is imminent?"
"I got my last letter from him in November. He said nothing about a war." The other three exchanged odd glances.
Sloat said, "Would he, in casual correspondence?"
"He might have asked me to come home. He didn't."
"Interesting," said Dr. Jastro, with a little complacent grin at Sloat, rubbing his tiny hands.
"As a matter of fact, I think there's going to be a war," Byron said. This caused a silence of a second or two, and more glances.
Jastro said, "Really? Why?"
"Well, I just toured Germany. You see nothing but uniforms, parades, drills, brass bands. Anywhere you drive, you end up passing army trucks full of troops and railroad cars loaded with artillery and tanks. Trains sometimes a couple of miles long."
"But, Byron, it was with just such displays that Hitler won Austria and the Sudetenland," said Jastro. "And he never fired the shot."
Natalie said to Byron, "Leslie thinks my uncle should go home. We've had a running argument for 3 days."
"I see."
Jastro was peeling a pear with elderly, deliberate gestures, using an ivory-handled knife.
"Yes, Byron, I'm being mulish."
The use of the word was accidental, for he grinned and added, "Being a hybrid of sorts myself, I guess. This is a comfortable house. It's the only home I have now, and my work is going well. Moving would cost me half a year. If I tried to sell the house, I couldn't find an Italian to offer me 5 cents on the dollar. They've been dealing for many centuries with foreigners who've had to cut and run. They'd skin me alive. I was aware of all this when I bought the villa. I expect to end my days here."
"Not this fall at the hands of the Nazis, I trust," Sloat said.
"Oh, hell, Sloat," Natalie broke in, slicing a flat hand downward through the air. "Since when does the Foreign Service have such a distinguished record for foresight? Since Munich? Since Austria? Since the Rhineland? Weren't you surprised every time?"
Byron listened with interest to this exchange. The others seemed to have forgotten he was at the table.
"Hitler has been making irrational moves with catastrophic possibilities," Sloat retorted. "Anybody can pull a gun in the street and shoot 4 people down before the cops come and stop him. Until now, that's been Hitler's so-called foreign policy brilliance in a nutshell. The surprise of an outlaw running wild. That game's played out. The others are aroused now. They'll stop him over Poland." Jastro ate a piece of pear and began to talk in a rhythmic, mellifluous way, something between meditating aloud and lecturing in a classroom.
"Leslie, if Hitler were the Kaiser, or a man like Charles XII, I admit I'd be worried. But he's far more competent than you think. Fortunately, the old ruling class is destroyed. They unleashed the world war with their dry-rotted incompetence, those preening, posturing, sleek royalties and politicians of 1914, those bemeddled womanizers and sodomites out of Proust. They never dreamed that the old manners, the old paperwork, the old protocol were done for, and that industrialized warfare would shatter the old system like a boot kicked through a dollhouse. So they went to the trash heap, and new leadership came up out of the sewers, where realism runs and change often starts. The early Christians haunted the sewers and catacombs of Rome, you know," Jastro said to Byron Henry, clearly relishing a fresh audience.
"Yes, sir, I learned about that."
"Of course you did. Well, Hitler's a vagabond, Mussolini's a vagabond, and Stalin's a jailbird. These are new, tough, able and clever men, straight up from the sewers. Lenin, another jailbird, was the great originator. He made it all up. Leslie, you realize
the Jesuitical secret party, the coarse slogans for the masses and the contempt for their intelligence and memory, the fanatic language, the strident dogmas, the Muslim religiosity and politics, the crude pageantry, the total cynicism of tactics. It's all Leninism. Hitler is a Leninist. Mussolini is a Leninist. The talk of anti-communism and pro-communism is for fools and children. Oh, for Pete's sake, Aaron, just a moment now. Lenin was all prudence and caution in foreign affairs, and that is my whole point. Glory and honor and all those tinsely illusions of the old system that led to wars were to Lenin the merest eyewash. So it is to Hitler. He has never moved when he couldn't get away with it. The outlaw running wild with a gun is the exact effect he wishes to create. I'm surprised that you're taken in. He is really a very, very prudent man. If he can make it in Poland without war, he'll do it. Otherwise, he'll not move, not now. Perhaps in 10 years, when he's built Germany up enough. I shall be very content to live another 10 years.
Sloat pulled at his mustache with lean, nervous fingers.
You really lose me, Aaron. Can you be serious? Hitler, a Leninist? That's a coffeehouse paradox, and you know it. The Russian Revolution is a radical change in history. The abolition of private property has created a new world. You may like it or detest it, but it's new. Hitler's socialism was a sham to get a mob of gangsters into power. He's frozen the German economy just as it was, smashed the labor unions, lengthened the working hours, cut the pay, and kept all the old rich crowd on top, the Krupps and the Thyssens, the men who gave him the money to run for office. The big Nazis live like barons, like sultans. The concentration camps are for anybody who still wants the socialist part of national socialism. Don't you know that? The 1934 purge was nothing but a showdown between the socialist element of the Nazi Party and the army generals and rich conservatives. Hitler shot his old party friends like partridges. That you rely on this man's prudence for your safety and for Natalie's strikes me as grotesque.
Does it?
Jastrow glanced at his watch and sighed.
I'm sorry. I'm impressed with Hitler's ability to use socialist prattle when necessary, and then discard it.
He uses doctrines as he uses money, to get things done. They're expendable. He uses racism because that's the pure distillate of German romantic egotism, just as Lenin used utopian Marxism, because it appealed to Russia's messianic streak. Hitler means to hammer out a united Europe. If a nonsense jumble of racist bunkum, socialist promises, brass bands, parades, uniforms, and weepy songs is what welds Germans into a blunt instrument, he gives them that. The Germans are stolid, clever, brutal, and docile, and they will vigorously execute any command barked at them with a loud enough voice. He understands them, and he may just succeed. A unified Europe must come. The medieval jigsaw of nations is obsolete. The balance of power is dangerous foolishness in the industrial age. It must all be thrown out. Somebody has to be ruthless enough to do it, since the peoples with their ancient hatreds will never do it themselves. It's only Napoleon's original vision, but he was a century ahead of his time. The old crowd was still strong enough to catch him and put him in a cage to die. But there's nobody to cage Hitler.
Byron blurted, Dr. Jastrow, when I was in Germany, I saw the signs on park benches and in trolley cars about the Jews. I saw burnt-out synagogues.
Yes?
They all looked at him. He went on, I'm surprised you talk as calmly about Hitler as you do. Being Jewish, I mean. Dr. Jastrow smiled a slow, acid smile, showing little yellowish teeth with one gold crown. He stroked his beard and spoke deliberately, the classroom note strong.
Well, your surprise doesn't surprise me. Young people, young Americans especially, aren't aware that the tolerance for Jews in Europe is only 50 to 100 years old, and that it's never gone deep. It didn't touch Poland, where I was born, even in the West. What about the Dreyfus case? No, no. In that respect, Hitler represents only a return to normalcy for Europe, after the brief glow of liberalism. The hostility simply moved from the church to the anti-Semitic parties, because the French Revolution changed Europe from a religious to a political continent. If Hitler does win out, the Jews will fall back to the second-class status they always had under the kings and the popes. Well, we survived 17 centuries of that. We have a lot of wisdom and doctrine for coping with it.
Sloat shook his head. You love to spin such talk, I know, but I wish you would do it on the next boat home.
But I'm quite serious, Leslie,
Jastrow said with a faintly puckish smile.
You rang wild alarms when Mussolini passed the anti-Jewish laws. They proved a joke.
They're on the books, if the Germans ever press him to use them.
The Italians loathe and fear the Germans to a man, even if, by some mischance, there is a war, Italy won't fight. Siena may well be as safe a place as any.
I doubt that Natalie's parents think so.
She can go home tomorrow. Perhaps she finds Siena slightly more attractive than Miami Beach.
I'm thinking of going, the girl said, but not because I'm afraid of war or of Hitler. There are things that bother me more.
I dare say, Jastrow said.
Sloat's face turned astonishingly red. His pipe lay smoking on an ashtray, and he was playing with a yellow pencil he had taken from a pocket, turning it in one fist. The pencil stopped turning. Jastrow stood. Byron, come along. They left the girl and the scarlet-faced man at the table, glowering at each other. Books filled the shelves of a small wood-paneled library and stood in piles on the desk and on the floor. Over a white marble fireplace, a stiff Sienese Madonna and child hung, blue and pink on gold, a tiny painting in a large, ornate, gilded frame.
Berenson says it's a Duccio,
Jastrow observed, with a little wave at the painting.
And that's good enough for me. It's not authenticated. Now then, you sit there in the light so that I can see you. Just put those magazines on the floor. Good. Is that a comfortable chair? Fine.
He sighed and laid a thumb against his lower lip.
Now, Byron, why didn't you go to the Naval Academy? Aren't you proud of your father?
Byron sat up in his chair.
I think my father may be chief of naval operations one day.
Isn't he worth emulating? My brother Warren's doing that. I'm just not interested.
Dr. Milano wrote that you took a naval reserve course and obtained a commission.
It made my father feel good.
And you've had no second thoughts about the Navy. It's not too late yet.
Byron shook his head, smiling. Jastrow lit a cigarette, studying Byron's face. The young man said,
Do you really like living in Italy, sir?
Well, I was ordered to a warm climate. I did first visit Florida, Arizona, Southern California, and the French Riviera.
The professor spoke these place names with an irony that wrote them off, one by one, as ridiculous or disagreeable.
Italy is beautiful, quiet, and cheap.
You don't mind making your home in a fascist country? Jastrow's smile was indulgent.
There are good and bad things in all political systems.
How did you ever come to write A Jew's Jesus, sir? Did you write it here?
Oh, no, but it got me here.
Jastrow spoke somewhat smugly.
I was using the Bible in a course on ancient history, you see. And as a boy in Poland, I'd been a Talmud scholar. So in teaching the New Testament, I tended to stress the rabbinic sources that Jesus and Paul used. This novelty seemed to fascinate Yale juniors. I cobbled up a book with the working title, Talmudic Themes in Early Christianity. And then, at the last minute, I thought of A Jew's Jesus. The Book of the Month Club selected it.
Jastrow made a soft gesture with both hands all around the room, smiling.
And here I am. The club payment bought this place. Now then, Byron, what are your plans? Are you going to return to the United States?
I don't know. I couldn't be more up in the air.
Do you want a job?
Byron was taken aback.
Well, I guess maybe I do, sir.
Jastrow ambled to his desk and searched through a pile of books, taking off his glasses and holding the titles very close to his face.
I had a fine researcher, a boy from Yale, but his parents called him home, afraid of a war. Ah, here we are. Can I interest you for $20 a week in the Emperor Constantine? This is a good general biography to start with.
Sir, I've flunked more history courses.
I see you don't want the job.
The young man took the thick book and turned it dubiously in his hands.
No, I'll try it. Thank you. Oh, you will you? When you say you have no aptitude. Why?
Well, for the money, and to be around you. This was true enough, though it omitted a third good reason. Natalie Jastrow. Jastrow looked stern, and then burst out laughing.
We'll give it a try.
The letter his parents received from him some time later about the girl, which elicited Victor Henry's strong answer, was unintentionally misleading. There was a love affair going on, but Natalie's lover was Leslie Sloat. His letters came two or three times a week, long, fat, white Foreign Service envelopes, addressed in an elongated stiff hand, in brown ink, with stamps stuck over the government franc. Byron hated the sight of them. He was spending hours every day with her in the huge second-floor room that was Jastrow's main library. Her desk was there. She answered letters, typed manuscripts, and with the Italian woman, managed the household. Byron worked at the long library table, reading up on Constantine, checking facts, and drawing maps of the emperor's military campaigns. Whenever he raised his eyes, he saw the smooth face bent over the desk, the shapely bones highlighted by sunshine, or on dark days by a lamp. There was also the ever-present view of her long, pretty legs in a sheen of silk. Natalie dressed in dun wool and was all business with him. She used almost no paint once Sloat left, combed her hair back into a heavy bun, and talked to Byron with offhand dryness. Still, his infatuation took quick root, and grew rankly. She was the first American girl he had spoken to in months, and they were thrown together for many hours every day, just the two of them, in the book-lined room. This was reason enough for him to feel attracted to her. But she impressed him, too. Natalie Jastrow talked to her famous uncle as to a mental equal. Her range of knowledge and ideas humiliated Byron, and yet there was nothing bookish about her. Girls in his experience were lightweights, fools for a smile and a bit of flattery. They had doted on him at college, and in Florence, too. Byron was something of an Adonis, indolent and not hotly interested. And unlike Warren, he had absorbed some of his father's straight-laced ideas. He thought Natalie was a dark jewel of intellect and loveliness, blazing away all unnoticed here in the Italian back hills. As for her indifference to him, it seemed in order. He had no thought of trying to break it down. He did things he had never done before. He stole a little pale blue handkerchief of hers and sat at night in his hotel room in town, sniffing it. Once he ate half a cake she had left on her desk because it bore the mark of her teeth. When she missed the cake, he calmly lied about it. Altogether, he was in a bad way. Natalie Jastrow seemed to sense nothing of this. Byron had a hard shell of inscrutability, grown in boyhood to protect his laziness and school failures from his exacting father. They chatted a lot, of course, and sometimes drove out in the hills for a picnic lunch, when she would slightly warm to him over a bottle of wine, treating him more like a younger brother. He soon got at the main facts of her romance. She had gone to the Sorbonne for graduate work in sociology. Jastrow had written about her to Sloat, a former pupil. A fulminating love affair had ensued, and Natalie had stormily quit Paris and lived for a while with her parents in Florida. Then she had come back to Europe to work for her uncle. Also, Byron surmised, to be near Sloat for another try. The Rhodes Scholar had now received orders to Warsaw, and Natalie was planning to visit him there in July while Jastrow took his summer holiday in the Greek islands. On one of their picnics, as he poured the last of the wine into her glass, Byron ventured a direct probe. "Natalie, do you like your job?" She sat on a blanket, hugging her legs in a heavy checked skirt, looking out over a valley of brown wintry vineyards. With an arch questioning look, cocking her head, she said, "Oh, it's a job. Why?"
"It seems to me you're wasting away here."
"Well, I'll tell you, Byron. You do peculiar things when you're in love." His response to this was a dull, unfocused expression. She went on. "That's one thing. Besides, frankly, I think Aaron's rather wonderful, don't you? Horribly crotchety and self-preoccupied and all that. But this Constantine book is good. My father is a warm, clever, good-hearted man, but he's the president of his temple, and he manufactures sweaters. Aaron's a famous author, and he's my uncle. I suppose I bask in his glory. What's wrong with that? And I certainly enjoy typing the new pages, just watching the way his mind works. It's an excellent mind, and his style is admirable." She gave him another quizzical look. "Now, why you're doing this, I'm far less sure."
"Me?" Byron said. "I'm broke."
Early in March, Jastrow accepted an offer from an American magazine for an article about the upcoming polio races. It meant he would have to put off his trip to Greece, for the race was run in July and again in August. But the fee was too absurdly fat, he said, to decline. If Natalie would watch the races and do the research, he told her, he would give her half the money. Natalie jumped at this, not perceiving, so Byron thought, that her uncle was trying to stop, or at least delay, her trip to Warsaw. Jastrow had once flatly said that Natalie's pursuit of Sloat was unladylike conduct and bad tactics. Byron had gathered that Sloat did not want to marry Natalie, and he could see why. For a foreign serviceman, a Jewish wife at this time would be disastrous, though Byron thought that in Sloat's place he would cheerfully give up the foreign service for her. Natalie wrote to Sloat that same day, postponing her visit until after the August polio. Watching her bang out the letter, Byron tried to keep joy off his face. She might go, he was thinking, and then again, she might not. Maybe a war would come along meantime and stop her. Byron hoped that Hitler, if he was going to invade Poland, would do it soon. When she finished, he went to the same typewriter and rattled off the famous letter to his parents. He intended to write one sheet and wrote seven. It was his first letter to them in months. He had no idea that he was picturing himself as an infatuated young man. He was, he thought, just describing his job, his employer, and the charming girl he worked with. And so Pug Henry got needlessly worked up and wrote the solemn reply, which startled and amused Byron when it came. For he was no more thinking of marrying Natalie Jastrow than of turning Mohammedan. He was just head over ears in love with a young woman